Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and across the world in business and in politics. Coming up on today's show, defence spending across Europe is increasing. Should we be doing the same here in Ireland? And with the Olympics starting this week, we thought we'd take a look back at how the games have evolved over the years. Philip Barker is the editor of the World Journal of Olympic History, and he's going to be on the show later to take us through the evolution of the greatest games on earth. You've heard of the art of war in business, but what about ethics in war and business? David Rodden is an Oxford-trained philosopher of war, and global leaders just can't get enough of him. He's going to be joining me later in the show to talk about some interesting observations on modern business practices. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. When you're running a business, how often do you use moral philosophy or medieval theories of just war? Do ethics make a business better? Well, my next guest has spent his career looking at both the philosophy of combat and how that can be used by businesses who want to build an ethical framework in their work. It's a real pleasure to welcome David Rodden, who's founder of Chair of Principia Consulting, to Taking Stock. Thank you very much for joining us today, David.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, maybe just tell us a little bit about your own background. You're an Oxford-trained philosopher of war.
Sure. Well, I grew up in New Zealand, came to study in Oxford, did my PhD on the ethics of war, and then ended up staying in Oxford really for 20 years, really working on issues around decision making in war, how to think ethically about war and the laws of war. And through that, I started to do a lot of work with militaries in different parts of the world. So I have spent a lot of time training senior officers in the British tri-services, spent a lot of time working with the US military. And 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to bring some of that learning out into the business world when I founded Principia. And last 10 years have been an absolute blast, actually, bringing some of that that experience out into the business world.
Maybe the best way to explain what you do is to actually just talk us through some of the examples of the companies that you work with, because the theory of adapting military tactics to business is not a new one, but taking ethics into it from a philosophical perspective is quite a unique way of looking at business, I think. So maybe start us off by talking to us about some of the companies that you work with.
Yeah, absolutely. So the starting point for a lot of the first clients that we worked with was that something very bad had happened, a major, major crisis. So we started working actually with big US Wall Street banks in the aftermath of 2008. So these were businesses that had just got themselves into a terrible state through really a series of very, very bad decisions, really unethical behaviors and decisions that they'd taken over a long period of time. And the question that we're really asking is, how can we understand what had gone wrong within our culture, within our values that led us to that state? And crucially, how do we recover and how do we get to a better place? So the way that we really thought about that was by first of all, trying to bring some of the lessons from the way that the military think about ethics and decision making. And, you know, as you said in your introduction, the roots of military ethics are very, very old. They go back to the Middle Ages through what's often called the just war theory. And just war theory is really provides a framework for military commanders and statesmen to think about what a permissible, justifiable war is and how to behave within that. And it gives you really a set of tools for thinking about what good decisions, what ethical, responsible action is. And what we realized is that a lot of that can actually help to inform decision-making by leaders within businesses as well. So what we really tried to do was to bring some of that kind of seriousness and rigor and attention to the ethical dimensions of decision-making and to really use that to improve the way that businesses run and the way that they deliver their services to their communities.
I've never quite understood the just war theory, whether it's a defined code and set of practices or it's a set of principles that you can adopt. Can you just talk us through what exactly it means or what it could mean in a military in a military sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really more a tradition of thought, which has a number of relatively well-defined principles, but ones that have been, you know, debated and developed over a very long period of time. So it really begins in the early middle ages with thinkers like Aquinas and Augustine, who were really struggling with this idea of, you know, how do we apply Christian ethics, which has a very strong pacifist element, to the running of an empire when the empire became Christian. And so they really started to develop a set of questions for testing whether it was just or ethical to use military force. And typically, there are a number of different tests that have to be applied. So the first test is there a just cause? So, you know, have you been attacked and are you acting in self-defense? Are you acting, you know, more modern times we might think about humanitarian intervention? Are you acting to defend the fundamental rights of others? So first test is there a just cause? But just cause isn't enough. You also have to have a legitimate authority. So you have to have a state or a body that is competent to declare war. It can't just be, you know, a terrorist group or a small, militia. So it has to be a legitimate authority. The use of force has to be proportionate. So that means that the harms that you will impose by the decision to use force can't be greater than or outweigh the goods you're trying to achieve. And finally, it has to be necessary. So that means that there can't be any less costly ways of achieving that same good end. Mm. And those are the kind of really fundamental tests. And then there are also a set of considerations about your obligations when you're fighting the war as well. That's sometimes called jus in bello, justice within the war. And the two fundamental tenets there are that you have to make sure that you are never deliberately targeting civilians. You can only target combatants. And secondly, that every use of force is proportionate. Again, it doesn't impose more costs than benefits.
I know we're talking about business today and how you apply those principles to make business better. But just as you're talking through the just cause and the behavior within war, so much of what's going on today and is called war seems not to meet those very basic benchmarks in so many instances. But look, you can see where the idea of philosophy comes into those fundamental decision-making processes if you apply the criteria you've just spoken about, going back to those fundamental principles of just do the right thing. So if I'm being entirely cynical about this and I'm looking at it from a company perspective, you could say if a company has a lot of trouble, if it's in a crisis management situation, of course the position it wants to get to is to be better, and to be ethically sound is a good way to do that. So, you know, is there any merit in looking at this as maybe a company just wanting to do the right thing really quickly, or to be seen to be doing the right thing really quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, when we first started working with businesses, almost all of the businesses that came to work with us did so because they had some kind of a crisis. And today, many of our clients are in that situation, but increasingly we're having businesses coming to us who are not in a crisis and who really want to work on their culture and work on their ethics proactively, if you like. And I think there are a couple of different reasons for that. So, you know, some of that is really just wanting to make sure that they don't fall into a crisis. Maybe they've had a peer competitor that's had something really bad happen. Maybe they've had a near miss, something kind of happened that could have been very bad and they caught it just in time. But increasingly, we're also finding businesses who, you know, come to us who are actually doing like really, really well. They have a very strong ethical foundation, but they want to do better. And some of those are very strong founder-led businesses. So we work very extensively, for example, with Salesforce in the US, which is led by Mark Benioff, you know, very charismatic founder who believes very strongly in social responsibility. We've worked a lot with a business in South Africa, Discovery Health, which operates in the UK. Again, founder-led business, really cares about ethics and doing the right thing, and really wants the best support possible to develop their leadership, their decision making, and their culture. So my sense is it's becoming a much, much more normal thing for businesses to actually really be engaging on this. Also, because I think just the you know, the expectations from society on businesses are so much, you know, so much greater, and the issues that businesses are having to engage with are so much more complex than they were maybe 15, 20 years ago, when we had this idea that, you know, essentially businesses were just there to maximize profits within the law. You know, no one really thinks that's kind of all the business is about today. There are these much wider set of expectations for businesses to engage on a whole range of issues. Mm. And that requires, you know, that requires real thought.
Yeah, I went to a presentation given by one of the Silicon Valley companies years ago, and they were talking about the future of work and the future of workers, and that employees and staff and the people who go to work will become much more discerning about who they will work for. And now we live in an era where ESG is really important for business in a financial sense as well, because they've got to hit targets. So I guess you could see something like this, the ethics of a company, the moral compass of a company, becoming more important as people decide more, who do I want to work for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the drivers are really coming from a number of directions. So certainly from investors, you know, particularly through ESG, also from consumers. So, you know, particularly consumer-facing businesses are very, very aware of the expectations and demands of consumers. But exactly as you say, from employees as well. That's becoming a very, very strong voice. So, you know, we do a lot of work with technology businesses, also professional services businesses, and it's very, very clear to those businesses that particularly, you know, Gen Z employees, they really look at the ethical stance of the businesses that they are thinking about working for. And, you know, if you want to be competitive in hiring and retaining those people, then, you know, you have to have something to say about that.
Mm. And just in your company and the consulting that you do now, do you have a mix of people, like, you know, from a military background who actually go in to a company and say, look, this is the military principle, this is how ethically we would operate, or do you do it from a different perspective completely?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that we work is we were really founded with this vision to take serious ethics out of the academy and to make it applicable to business. And the starting point was really people like me, so people who are specialists in military ethics. But as we've grown, we've really developed a much more diverse team. So we have philosophers who have worked on a range of different issues, not only on military issues, but also many others. And then increasingly also non-philosophers as well. So we now have behavioral scientists, we have data scientists, we have a psychiatrist. And, you know, to me, it's really interesting to build a multidisciplinary team and to really work on the diverse set of skills that we find, you know, are really necessary to help businesses to develop these capacities around culture and ethics.
Absolutely. Yeah. Interesting you mentioned multidisciplinary teams, because there is no one solution to that problem. And depending on the company that you're encountering, it could have a different need depending on what system it's operating in. But I just want to talk to you a bit about the non-business side of things for a second, because obviously you're tremendously well-read in military ethics, and you've done a lot of studying. And as you look at the world today and military ethics as it has evolved, do you think that the world we live in now, that ethical sense has been diluted?
I don't think so. So if you look over the long history, violence has been declining very, very significantly. And it's hard for us to see that, because we look at the world today and it looks like it's in flames. But if you compare that to the way that the world was, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, the standards are actually much higher and the world is much less violent than it was. And, you know, I see that just only, you know, even through my career. So, you know, I've seen that militaries are so much more attentive to this, to the way that they train and develop their personnel, to the sophistication of the support that they give to their people. Now, does that mean that they always get it right? Absolutely not. And does it also mean that things only go in one direction? No, neither that, because we do see, you know, real tragedies and real backwards moves. And I would say that the conflict that we're seeing in Gaza at the moment is really a horrendous example of really unethical conduct on both sides. So I think it doesn't go in a straight line, but I think, you know, over the long term, I think there is definitely progress being made.
Final question for you, David. Did you ever think about joining the military yourself?
Great question. So I'm not quite a pacifist, but I'm very, very close to being a pacifist. And I think there are huge amounts of the military life that I love and really respect. But I think that the actual use of lethal force, the killing of other people, would be something that's very, very difficult to me. So I love having the role that I have now of really being a thinking partner with militaries. I have many, many friends who are leaders and soldiers. But I'm not sure it would have been the right life for me.
Okay, David, listen, well, it has been fascinating talking to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. That was David Rodden, founder, chair of Principia Consulting. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up, Europe is increasing its spending on defence. Should Ireland do the same? Find out after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we saw the 75th anniversary of NATO being marked by a summit in Washington. Instead of celebrating, NATO members who were gathered there were in quite a somber mood, knowing that the world is still in a very dangerous place. Well, Ireland, as a neutral state, is not in NATO, but it's not immune to aggressive actions by Russia. Well, how well prepared are we, and what should we be doing about our own defence systems? And should we be taking the issue much more seriously? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Jackie King, the Executive Director of IBEC Global. You're very welcome, Jackie.
Ah, thanks for having me.
Jackie, we'll have all seen Minister Jennifer Carroll McNeill writing in the Sunday Independent recently about the need to have a deeper conversation about our defence mechanisms. And she specifically was talking about funding. Do you think, as she purports, that we need to do more in terms of having a conversation and then invest more in our defence systems?
Short answer is yes, absolutely. Both from a defense readiness and it's part of our infrastructure. It's what our investors rely on and consider when they're investing here. And every citizen should have that expectation that we have as a country, even as a neutral one, have the ability to defend itself.
And it's interesting that you say it's something that our investors expect, because, you know, we come from a neutral country. We don't ever really think about that. But maybe in the same ways we haven't thought previously about energy being an issue for investors coming in here, we have to start thinking about those big things now, because obviously defence means much more in Europe than it has ever before, because obviously we've got a war on the margins of Europe at the moment. So do you see, through your contacts in IBEC, that more people are actually requiring that sort of security, literally security, before they actually consider a location?
Absolutely. Security and stability is important on many fronts when they're making those investment decisions. And, you know, when we think about defense and security in general, you know, you think tanks and planes and guns. Warfare is very, very different, and defense certainly is very, very different these days with cyber. And of course, Ireland, the economy, it's an imperative to our systems, our citizens and our economy, that we take that seriously. So investment in our cyber infrastructure to create both, enhance our defense and our opportunities here. When you think about the undersea cables that are vital to international connectivity, when you think that 30% of our of the data housed in Europe is in Ireland, that's why the big companies invest here. That's why the small ones are able to thrive and grow and start up. So that's something we need to take seriously and consider it when we look at the defense mix. It's not just about the physical, although that's important, but we have to look at the digital.
You're right. The whole concept of how we think of defense really has to change. It's not just about personnel now. It's about, you know, what's going on in the ether, what's going on underground, and what's compromised. So maybe talk to me a little bit about the exposure in a European sense, because one of the quotes I saw in that article from Jennifer Carroll McNeill was about a German minister who was saying that Europe needs to prepare for a war by the end of the decade. So how do we compare in that? Like, are some of the member states across Europe doing a lot more than we are at the moment? Like, are we playing a big game of catch up?
Oh, I think all of Europe's playing a big game of catch up. Since the Cold War, I think defense spending has decreased from something around 3.6% of GDP down to roughly around 1.8%. Now it's increasing, but across Europe, the target that everybody looks to, whether you're a NATO country or not, is 2%. Right now, there are only 7 countries in Europe that are achieving the 2% spend on defense. France at the 2% level, right up to Greece that's spending almost 4%. Why does that matter? Because far too long we have been, you know, some would say outsourcing our security to the United States, and we're hearing signals not just because of Trump's rise to the presidency again. But over the past number of years, the challenges Biden's had in securing support for Ukraine, for example. And I think what it's unearthed is all of the gaps that exist in our ability to defend ourselves as a bloc. And so the readiness is not there. So we're going to be playing catch up. There are commitments to do that. Certainly Ursula von der Leyen, who has just been elected as the president of the European Commission for a second term. Part of a central plank in her election campaign was, you know, defense as a key pillar. And the Commission has introduced a defense industrial policy that will see a uniting of countries that will come together. Defending your country will always be a sovereign purview, but certainly combining our efforts in terms of procurement and where we spend our money and how we get ready and fill the gaps of what's missing today.
Yeah, and that European influence and cover, if you like, is already manifesting itself. Earlier this month, the Dáil voted for new defence motions, including the approval to join the European Defence Agency cyber defence exercises and all of that. And previously, that would have, I think, provoked an awful lot more debate than it actually did. But there is that growing recognition that we need to do more. Do you think that Europe will help us in that regard by providing those bigger macro pictures for us to follow?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's part of the benefit of being part of the European Union, right? You do get the thinking and the support and the structure and the policy that we have an ability to influence, first of all, but also that we are a collective solving a collective issue. So I think, yeah, there will be supports and there will be opportunities for Irish companies as well within the new defense industrial policy scheme, because, you know, it's not just, we're not making ships and planes here, but we have leaders in cyber technology and drone technology and lasers and all the things that would go into components of whatever would be included in a defense industrial package of products.
Yeah, and that's another interesting angle, because we tend to think of defense as purely reactive or guarding and cautionary, but it's big business and there's opportunity in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where in Ireland then are they looking at cyber security issues? Are there companies that are looking at this specifically, or is there an area that is good at this? I guess we have a long tradition at being good at those electronic businesses, don't we? Our connection with that big digital world has evolved even since the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, there's cyber clusters all around. You know, Cork has a great one, and the whole ecosystem of cybersecurity. So there's all these ancillary companies that feed into that ecosystem that are, you know, haven't even been thought of yet that students coming out of university are creating, right up to some of the bigger guys that are being acquired by multinationals and some of the multinationals that are investing in R&D here. So it is a big opportunity for Ireland and for the island of Ireland, for that matter.
And do you see universities in the course of your business, do you see universities paying more attention to this and trying to get graduates more involved in the cyber area defense and stuff?
Absolutely, absolutely. We did quite a bit of work. We're very much involved in the D9 Plus. Those are the digitally advanced countries. And we have Ireland, IBEC leads the B9 Plus, the business part of that. And so we are, you know, we work with businesses and academic institutions in advancing some of the skills in that area. So again, the short answer is yes.
So back to what Jennifer Carroll McNeill was talking about and the increase in spending that she was advising. She referred back to the report of the Commission on Defence Forces laying out three possible tiers of new spending, and the government chose the second one. But there was a third option, which was about developing a full spectrum defence capability to protect us. An overview of what that might look like if we were to go to that level?
Yeah, well, I mean, our position at IBEC has not been to put a number on it, but certainly to say that there needs to be a consistent commitment and a plan to get up to that level. I think the current plan now for 2028 is to bring it up to, above almost 0.7% of GDP, 7-8, and that's a significant increase up from where it is now, which is, I think, roughly around 0.23% of GDP. So our position is that there needs to be a steady commitment and see, and you know, year after year, a plan to achieve that. If it's more, great, but you know, like every other country, there's pressures on government to spend and where they're going to put their money, especially going into an election period.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a game changer for everything.
Yeah.
Jackie, we started off talking about the NATO summit. And just to conclude around that again, you mentioned that the goal for global investment in defence is 2%. And at that summit, President Biden said, look, 23 members of NATO are now achieving that 2%, which is a good thing. But there was, it was a very kind of somber meeting. And things are changing every day. Mm. But maybe just give us your view of that global geopolitical space that you observed from the NATO perspective, as insofar as it pertains to defence. Do you think it was a rallying call to sort of get us ready for something?
Yeah, I don't think it's a rallying call to prepare for World War III or anything that dramatic, although it is that dramatic because we're seeing multiple conflicts all over the world at the same time. It's not just the war in Ukraine, what's happening in, with Taiwan and China and certainly as a result of what's happening in the Gulf. But I think it's been a wake-up call to say we need to be ready and we need to be resilient as you know, like-minded thinking nations. And the somber mood was, you know, a little bit with the Trump cloud that hung over everything because he's made it very, very clear that countries need to pull their weight or the U.S. will not be supporting in a way that they have. And so that's quite frightening to some. So I think that's where the somber mood came from mostly, is what do we do now and how do we get ready?
And it was almost a little bit of future-proofing against the possibility of Donald Trump coming back in, which is looking more and more likely every passing day.
It certainly is. And future-proofing is the way to go. It's how do we become resilient? How do we protect our citizens, not just today, but well into the future? And that's an argument that's going to have to be made to our citizens as well. But we're seeing signals of support for defense, as you mentioned earlier. Even the Eurosceptics in the EU in pre-voter polls. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, certainly more awareness of it, more discussion about it. And Jackie, thank you very much for coming in and chatting to us about it today. That was Jackie King, the executive director of IBEC Global.
Thank you.
This is News Talks Taking Stock. After the break, Philip Barker, editor of the Olympic History, will discuss the origins and evolution of the Olympics. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. Take a listen to this. That was, of course, the iconic opening music from The Chariots of Fire, because it's all eyes on Paris at the moment as we look at the 2024 Olympic Games. So today we thought we'd take a look at how the Games have evolved over the years. For more on this, I'm delighted to be joined now by Philip Barker, who's the editor of the Journal of Olympic History. Philip, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you.
Now, Philip, let's start in Paris and with this year's Olympic. What's new in the 2024 Olympic Games?
Well, the new sport is breakdancing. They're calling it breaking, and a lot of the athletes who take part in this will have special names. So they compete under their, it's almost like an alias that they use when they're doing their breaking. And this is part of an effort to make sure that the Games appeal to young people. We've also got skateboarding, which made a successful entry in Tokyo, and surfing, which is not actually in Paris, but in Tahiti, because they don't have the facilities to do surfing on the French coast. So they've taken it all the way over to Tahiti, and even in another continent, which is not quite a first for the Olympics, but this is something pretty unusual, so that's going to be spectacular as well. And we've got three-on-three basketball, which proved very popular when it was started. This is where you just have the one board and two teams circulating around that, and that attracts huge crowds, almost as much as the regular basketball does with teams like the Dream Team. So it's all about trying to get young people engaged by the Olympics, and I think that's what they're planning. They're calling these games the Wide Open Games. That's what the organisers call them. So hopefully, all the youngsters will be absolutely in front of their TV screens or their mobile devices, just following the game throughout, because they'll be captivated by it.
Well, Philip, never did I think when I was spinning around a piece of lino in the 80s that it was going to become an Olympic sport someday. I didn't even know breakdancing was still happening. I'm sure it's going to appeal to people of a certain vintage. I'm not sure young people are going to be attracted to it, but like definitely we'd be looking out for that. Philip, you've obviously been looking at the Olympic Games for many years, and you've seen it evolve over time. Maybe just take us through the major changes as you see them, from how it started to where it is at now in terms of sport. We'll get into other things like politics and broadcasting in a minute, but in terms of sport, how has it evolved?
Well, for one thing, you've got women's events in a lot of the sports, which simply didn't happen in the first Olympics in 1896, and then from 1900 on, it was very, very limited. They had tennis and archery and a bit of golf and that sort of thing, but nothing strenuous. And women didn't get into athletics until 1928.
It's hard to believe, isn't it, really?
It is hard to believe. Now, the first women's marathon didn't actually take place until 1984. That's even more shocking.
Wow.
But now we've got to a point where in Paris for 2024, we're going to have gender equality, the same number of events for men and women. And there are quite a few teams that actually have more competitors who are women than men. So that's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. But, it's been a trend over the last few years. We saw how how Ireland did so well in the women's hockey tournament a couple of years ago, the World Cup, when they reached the final. And then you had the Lionesses from this part side of the water in the Euros and the World Cup. And the interest in the women's sport has grown exponentially over the years. I mean, they've had some odd sports as well. The first Paris Games, which were in 1900, they actually had a swimming obstacle race in the Seine. Now, I know this week the River Seine has been right and center in publicity, because every politician worth their salt seems to be oodling to jump into the water and swim to show that it's all nice and clean. But I see they've had Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo, the Olympics Minister Amelie Oudéa-Castéra has been in as well. So you just kind of wonder who's going to drop in next.
Obviously, you know, very intent on using Paris as a wonderful backdrop. And I know that sustainability is a big thing for this Olympic Games. They're trying to minimise on the new infrastructure.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of the teams are actually arriving by train. From the local areas, Belgium, the Netherlands and Great Britain, certainly. And obviously, it's not quite as straightforward for the Irish Olympic team, but, you know, because they've got the water to negotiate there, but they haven't got Eurostar. But, you know, teams are sort of very aware. And apart from the swimming complex, there's not been a lot of new building going on. They're trying to make use of what they had before. Like the Stade de France, which will be the athletics venue, was from the 1998 World Cup. And they've got a lot of places, the breaking, for example, and the other sports there will take place in what they call demountable venues, which basically means temporary stands and a lot of bunting to make it look nice for the TV cameras. And, you know, then they can take it all down afterwards and you'd never know that the Olympics have been there. But that area around the centre of Paris is going to be absolutely buzzing over the next few weeks. Absolutely. I'm sure, you know, I mean, you see the way that people have reacted the other week to the torch relay arriving. Now that the games are on, you know, I think the buzz is really going to take off.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we've talked about what's new. We've talked about some of the bits that they've left out. Are any of the formats changing that we should look out for this year?
Well, they're not changing this year. The modern pentathlon, which has traditionally included horses, this will be the last time that they're going to have that. This is the five events. It features swimming, fencing, a sort of show jumping course, and then a run-shoot event. After this year, they're looking at introducing an obstacle course instead of the horses for this. Now, there's been a lot of controversy over this. It all goes back to Tokyo when there was that incident because the riders don't get to ride their own horses. They have to choose them from a lottery of a number of horses. And if you get a horse that's been spooked or is in some way not in a very good mood that day, it can spell calamity on the show jumping course. And this is what happened to one of the German riders. And she took it very well. And obviously, she was very disappointed because she was leading the competition. But her coach went and gave the horse a bit of a slap. And this did not look good on TV, and it really upset everyone. And the coach was given a disciplinary black mark and so forth. And this sort of started the ball rolling. Well, maybe we should find something else other than horses to protect the animals. So that's going to change in 2028. And we've got cricket coming in 2028 as well. So the Olympics each time evolves because each city has got the right to actually include a few things that they think will get big crowds. So in Tokyo, for example, they had softball and baseball. Now, as it is, it didn't attract big crowds because we had COVID and no one was allowed, no spectators were permitted. But that was the theory. Here we've got the breaking, which they think is going to attract a big audience. Bizarrely, Los Angeles haven't chosen to include breaking. Now, when you think of the Fresh Prince of Bel Air and all those sort of things, you'd have thought that breaking would have been a must for Los Angeles, but it hasn't been. But they keep changing the program, trying to include stuff that's going to be attractive in that part of the world so that people will be engaged by it, you know. But back in 1924, when the Olympics were last in Paris, they actually had art contests.
Wow. Yeah,
and, you know, Ireland won a medal. Ireland won a medal.
Did we? And did you did you say that at the did you mention that one of the first Olympics that we competed in was in France?
Yes, that's right. 1924. That was the first time the Irish tricolour was seen at the Olympics.
Wow.
Because it came after independence and they actually had an Irish Olympics that very same year, which was based on the old Olympics that were held in Ireland, a sort of multi-sport event. And after the Olympics, they thought, well, we've got lots of people with Irish heritage from America, Canada, you name it. let's bring them all over to Ireland and have a big competition to celebrate the Olympics. And so this Tailteann Games took place in Ireland after the Olympics with all a lot of the stars who'd been competing in Paris. So they were very much onto it. They didn't start winning gold medals in the athletic arena until 1928 and then 1932. But it was a big deal for Ireland to get in.
That's a great idea, Philip. Maybe we could resurrect that. That's a fantastic idea to bring everybody back here. And we, of course, do have huge high hopes for our athletics team again this year. Philip, as well as what's happening on the pitch and on the field and in the arenas, politics always plays a really big part in the Olympics. We do live in, sadly, a very fractured world at the moment, but what have the standout political events and global conflicts been that have affected Olympic Games in the past?
Well, you have to say, first of all, the world wars, because there were supposed to be Olympics in 1916 in Berlin, of all places, and that was cancelled because of the world war. In 1940, they were originally assigned to Tokyo, and then the Japanese government decided to invade China, so they gave up on the Games. Then they were reassigned to Finland, to Helsinki, and they didn't happen because Finland was at war with the Soviet Union. And London was actually chosen for the 1944 Games, and they never happened because by that time the whole world was engulfed in this terrible conflict. Mm. And when they don't happen, they still keep the number. And so all they say is that the Berlin Games 1916 were supposed to be the Games of the Sixth Olympiad. So it says allocated but not celebrated. Mm. So that they still stay in that line so that the actual sequence of Olympiads remain unchanged. But of course, they don't happen. So that's the first thing. Then you get to sort of boycotts and other things like revolutions. In 1956, for example, Hungary had a revolution. The Soviets sent the tanks in, and the Hungarian team had to escape by what means they could from Budapest during the uprising. They arrived in Australia, and luck would have it, or ill luck would have it, they were drawn against the Soviets in the water polo competition. And fights broke out, both in the crowd and on the in the water. And it was known as the Blood in the Water Games, you know, because they came off both sides. Water polo is pretty violent at the best of times. And, you know, blows were exchanged. Mm. And then we had boycotts in 1976 over New Zealand's rugby tour of South Africa. A lot of the African countries boycotted. 1980. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Ireland went, same with Britain, and they both decided they weren't going to use their national flags. They used the Olympic flag whenever they competed. So, but they went to the Games. And then in 1984, what happened? A tit-for-tat boycott. All the Soviets decide to stay away from the Games in Los Angeles. So, you know, you have these boycotts going on. That doesn't seem to happen now, but we have still got a problem in Paris.
And that brings us right up to date. So what's happening with the various countries who are involved in conflict this year?
Well, at the moment, there's still debate. There's been no official word on what might happen regarding Israel and Palestine with the Gaza situation and the suffering there. But with Ukraine, there is. Belarus and Russia are both banned from taking part in the Olympics under their national flags. Hmm. But what they have done is they have created a neutral team with its own little flag for athletes who qualify. But they have to also, as well as qualifying sporting-wise, they have not to have supported the war in any way. So that means you saw some of the athletes who wore this Z on their shirts. That's not allowed. If they're a member of the armed forces or the security forces, that's not permitted either. So they had to go through a very strict regulation process. There are about 30 of them have come through this and will compete as neutral athletes. Mm. And then we've also got a refugee Olympic team for those who've been displaced by conflicts over the years. This has happened for the last three Olympics, and they will come in right at the start of the the games. They're about 30, 35, 37 of them from about 15 countries originally. and they are now living in other countries. So we'll see them very much in great prominence from the start of the games. You know, they've been training near Bayeux, where the tapestry comes from, just to get their fine tuning done. But they're hoping that one of them might even win a medal at some point. It's unlikely, but that would be a strong symbol.
They could live in hope. Before we let you go, I just want to ask as well about the Paralympics.
Yeah. The Paralympics will follow on about... it's about almost a month later, because they have to change everything around. Although there's one thing they won't have to change, because they've already got the Paralympic symbol on the Arc de Triomphe.
Okay.
And this is the first time they put them both up at the same time. Normally, the Olympic rings go up, the Olympics, they get taken down, and then the Paralympic agitosk, the symbol that they have, goes up around the city. But this time, it's a sort of gesture of solidarity and a gesture of togetherness. They've decided that they've got the rings on the Eiffel Tower, which I'm sure you've seen, and they've got the agitos on the Arc de Triomphe. So it shows that basically the Paralympics and the Olympics, they're all together. The organising committee is pretty much the same anyway for both, and the people running the games. You know, the idea is to make sure that everybody feels included.
Absolutely. And look, another sign of evolution in the games. Philip, I'll be watching out for the breakdancing to see if we can take home a medal in that one. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking to you. That was Philip Barker, editor of the Journal of Olympic History. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy. Stephen Daunt was on research and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, please email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.